Hello, today is Thursday, February 19th, 2026. My name is Elizabeth Ingber with the Talking Information Center. This is USA Today. Republican Party. Anti-Muslim dogs post prompts calls for Republican congressman to resign by Catherine Palmer. Representative Randy Fine, a first-term Republican congressman from Florida, is facing calls to resign over accusations of Islamophobia after suggesting he prefers dogs to Muslim people. If they force us to choose, the choice between dogs and Muslims is not a difficult one, Fine said in a post to social media on Sunday, February 15th. He was responding to a post by a pro-Palestinian activist who said that dogs should not be indoor pets, who later clarified she was making a joke about dog owners not cleaning up after their pets on New York City's snow-lined streets. "Like we've said all along, they are unclean," she said. Some interpretations of Islam place restrictions on keeping dogs as pets. Fine's comments were met with condemnation from leading Democrats, including Minority Leader Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and California Governor Gavin Newsom. Jeffries said in a statement that Fine is a disgrace to Congress and called him an Islamophobic, disgusting, and unrepentant bigot. The Democratic leader also slammed House Speaker Mike Johnson and House Republicans for not speaking up about the comments. Even conservative commentator Megyn Kelly, who routinely irks progressives and liberals, said Fine's comments went full bigot. "Their casual acceptance of hateful and divisive language enables this out-of-control behavior. Republican leaders must hold this so-called member of Congress accountable," Jeffries said. Congressional Democrats are also increasingly calling for Fine to be censured and stripped of his committee assignments. "This is genuinely one of the most disgusting statements I have ever seen issued by an American official," Ocasio-Cortez said on February 17th of Fine's post. As he'd done with several other negative responses to his comments on X, Fine retweeted Jeffrey's statement with an image of a dog imposed on a bright yellow "Don't Tread on Me" flag. Since his post over the weekend, Fine has doubled down, reposting clips of himself defending his comments on a conservative talk show program and responding to dozens of posts, including some denouncing him, with the altered flag illustration. It is not the first time the Florida congressman, who is Jewish and has referred to himself as the Hebrew Hammer, has shared anti-Muslim and Islamophobic comments. In July 2025, he sparked backlash when he insinuated that Representative Ilhan Omar, who is Muslim, was a terrorist. He has also used the word to insult other Muslim leaders like Representative Rashida Tlaib and New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani. In December 2025, Fine called for mass deportations of Muslim people from the country, along with a Muslim travel ban and citizenship revocations. He wrote in a post at the time that mainstream Muslims have declared war on us. Before joining Congress, Fine built a reputation as a controversial figure in Florida state politics. He's previously called for the expulsion of any non-Americans who are or have advocated for Muslim terror, according to the Floridian. He also accused Florida Governor Ron DeSantis of failing to address anti-Semitism in 2023. He served in the Florida State Legislature beginning in 2016 and was elected to serve in the State Senate in 2024. Fine won a special election in 2025 to fill an empty U.S. House seat representing a northern Florida district which covers Daytona Beach as well as the Ocala National Forest. Jeffrey Epstein. Whoopi Goldberg on being mentioned in Epstein files. "I wasn't his girlfriend. I wasn't his girlfriend, I wasn't his friend," Whoopi Goldberg said about Jeffrey Epstein, by Melina Kahn. Whoopi Goldberg has addressed her name appearing in the files released by the Department of Justice on Jeffrey Epstein, saying in part, "I wasn't his girlfriend." During the February 17th episode of The View, the EGOT holder said she's getting dragged over an email correspondence between Epstein and a redacted sender mentioning Goldberg seeking a private plane. "In the name of transparency, my name is in the files," Goldberg said as a copy of the email was shown on screen. The correspondence, which is dated May 8, 2013, says, in part, "Whoopi Goldberg needs a plane to get to Monaco. John Lennon's charity is paying for it. They don't want to charter, so they are looking for private owners." The redacted sender goes on to detail an event that month in Monaco hosted by the White Feather Foundation, an environmental and health conservative group founded by musician Julian Lennon. The sender asks Epstein, "Would you want to offer the G2, seemingly a reference to one of Epstein's planes? In response, Epstein wrote, "No thanks." A review of the files released by the Department of Justice showed Goldberg's name appearing in other documents, including news articles mentioning the actress. The library contains all files collected for the department's investigations, so not all documents are from direct correspondence with Epstein. The May 8, 2013 email appears to be the only file that shows a direct connection between Epstein and Goldberg. Goldberg has not been accused of any wrongdoing tied to Epstein. Whoopi Goldberg addresses her name in Epstein files on The View. During the show, Goldberg read the email aloud, to which her co-host, Joy Behar, said, "So, in other words, anybody can be on this list." Well, this is my point, because I'm telling you, when I tell you people are trying to turn me into, "I wasn't his girlfriend, I wasn't his friend," Goldberg said. When co-host Sarah Haynes said, "You were too old for him," Goldberg responded, "I was not only too old, but it was at a time, you know, where this is just not. You used to have facts before you said stuff. I'm getting dragged. People actually believe that I was with him," Goldberg continued. "It's like, honey, come on. Every man that I've ever been with, you've known about him. People wrote about this stuff. So no, I never had this, and no, I didn't get on the plane." Goldberg and her fellow hosts on The View have discussed the Epstein files many times on the show. She previously addressed rumors during the January 4th, 2024 episode about her name appearing in the files. "Apparently they said I was on the island, and I don't go anywhere," she said at the time, in reference to Epstein's private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. "So I'm just going to say, and there's just been a lot of stuff recently, I don't know what I've done to anybody, but apparently there are a lot of these sites people don't realize they can be harmful." Donald Trump. Marjorie Taylor Greene criticizes Trump administration. "I'm not in a cult," by Katherine Palmer. Former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, once one of President Donald Trump's staunchest allies, has again unleashed criticism on the administration, laying into the Republican Party as it gears up for the 2026 midterm elections. Greene criticized the party on a range of issues, warning its actions regarding health care costs, the Epstein files, and its support of Trump's aggressive foreign policy decisions will cost the GOP in the November elections. "If you had put America first from the start, instead of your rich donor class and foreign policy, you would not have to strategize on how to gaslight Americans," Greene said in a long social media post on Tuesday, February 17th. "If you had not called the Epstein files a hoax and treated the Epstein survivors, rape and trafficking victims, like they didn't exist, and if you would release all the files and put your rich, powerful friends in prison, then Americans might actually listen to your messaging." Greene also entreated the party to stop the bullying, harassment, and name-calling, writing that it was immature and was turning people away. Greene became a household name early in her congressional career, often grabbing attention for her conspiratorial beliefs and polarizing comments. Yet the Georgia congresswoman began to publicly split with the president and leaders of her party in 2025, culminating in a falling out with the president in the last few months of the year. Green criticized House GOP leadership during the historic government shutdown that began in October 2025, airing concerns about rising health care costs that Democrats cited as their reason for denying a vote on a spending package to reopen the government. In the following weeks, she tore into Trump for his foreign policy, taking issue with his foreign trips and hosting international dignitaries, arguing he needed to focus more on domestic issues in line with MAGA's America First credo. The administration's handling of the Epstein files also enraged the Congresswoman. She became one of a few Republicans who vocalized their discontent with the administration's and party's approach to the matter. Trump has publicly rebuked Green over the past few months, more recently calling her a traitor. She repeated those top complaints in her post and accused the GOP of covering up for pedophiles. "And you can call me all the petty names you want," Green said in her fiery post. "I don't worship a man, I'm not in a cult, and I refuse to fight for a team that refuses to win." Green announced her resignation from Congress in November 2025 and officially vacated her seat in January. Kid Rock. Kid Rock drinks milk in a hot tub with RFK Jr. in Wild Workout Video by Anna Kaufman. Kid Rock is further cementing his alignment with the Trump administration. In a new video posted to X by Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the all-summer-long singer can be seen completing various workouts against the backdrop of head-slamming rock music. The montage, which looks more like a training sequence from one of the Rocky movies than a government PSA, shows the two men on a stationary bike in a sauna doing sit-ups and using various other gym equipment. "I've teamed up with @KidRock to deliver two simple messages to the American people. Get active and eat real food," Kennedy wrote in the caption. The video, leaning into Kennedy's ultra-macho aesthetic, shows him in a man cave of sorts, working out in blue jeans and downing raw milk. At one point, Kid Rock flips off the camera, while in another shot, he stands beside Kennedy, holding up an American flag positioned near a small replica of the Statue of Liberty. The video closes with the phrase, "Make America Healthy Again," Kennedy's signature phrase for his professed overhaul of the American diet. Kid Rock, a close ally of President Donald Trump, is fresh off a performance at Turning Point USA's alternative halftime show. The conservative organization, founded by late right-wing activist Charlie Kirk, put on a competing concert during this year's Super Bowl as a protest against the NFL's choice of Bad Bunny as a headliner. Bad Bunny, who hails from the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, has been critical of Trump's immigration crackdown. Some conservative pundits seized on that fact as reason to boycott his performance, along with the fact that the reggaeton star sings almost exclusively in Spanish. Lent. Do Christians eat meat on Ash Wednesday? What to Know About Lent by Julia Gomez. Do Christians eat meat on Ash Wednesday? The answer is yes and no, depending on their denomination. Many Catholics do not eat meat on Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, or any Fridays during Lent. The rule is not steadfast across Christianity. Presbyterians, Lutherans, and other Christian denominations that observe Lent may not have the same dietary restrictions. Lent is not exclusively observed by Catholics, but is also practiced by Orthodox Christians and Protestants, including Anglican, Lutheran, Methodist, Presbyterian, and some evangelical churches. However, the practice of refraining from eating meat is primarily observed among Catholics, who opt to eat fish instead of poultry, pork, and red meat. Here is what to know about eating meat and fasting on Ash Wednesday, February 18th, and during Lent, which begins February 18th and ends April 2nd. Catholics avoid eating meat on Ash Wednesday. Many Catholics abstain from eating meat on Ash Wednesday and every Friday during Lent, including Good Friday. Since Jesus sacrificed his flesh for us on Good Friday, we refrain from eating flesh meat in his honor on Fridays, stated the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Flesh meat includes the meat of mammals and poultry, such as beef, pork, chicken, and turkey. William Johnston, an associate professor of religious studies at the University of Dayton, previously told USA Today that abstaining from eating meat is also a form of penance, admitting to any wrongdoings and sins while turning back to belief in God. What can Catholics eat while abstaining during Lent? On days when people abstain from eating meat, the most popular choice is fish, according to previous USA Today reporting. The Archdiocese says fish, shrimp, crab, lobster, and other shellfish can be eaten. Those who do not have a taste for seafood can opt for non-flesh animal products like milk, eggs, cheese, and butter. Fasting during Lent. Some Catholics fast on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday, April 3rd, according to USA Today's previous reporting. But Roman Catholic guidelines for fasting differ from those in other faiths that require believers to abstain from food or drink for extended periods. In the Church's directions for fasting, it says one regular-sized meal and two smaller meals that don't equal that regular-sized meal. Father Dustin Dott, the Executive Director of the Secretariat of Divine Worship of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, previously told USA Today, there is no specific portion size set in the rule. Dott says it's relative, depending on the person and life stage. A full meal for someone who does very intense bodily work may be different from a full meal for someone who does not, said Dott. According to Dott, the only Roman Catholics who are obligated to fast are people aged 18 to 59. What is Ash Wednesday? Ash Wednesday marks the beginning of Lent, a period for repentance and prayer, according to the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, USCCB. It is also a time when people are asked to perform acts of charity. On this day, many Christians mark their Lent journey by receiving ashes made from the palms distributed during the previous year's Palm Sunday celebration, the first day of Holy Week, which commemorates Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. Many Catholics will attend a Mass where the priests will smudge ashes on their foreheads in the shape of a cross. The season of prayer lasts 40 days, excluding Sundays, and ends on Holy Thursday, April 2nd. It is when Christians prepare to celebrate the Lord's resurrection at Easter. Politics. Trump is losing support on immigration. What is his approval rating? By Kinsey Crowley. A new poll out shows President Donald Trump is continuing to lose support on immigration. A Reuters Ipsos poll conducted February 13th through 16th found just 38% of respondents approved of how Trump is handling immigration. That is down from the high of 50% earlier in his term, according to Reuters. The poll was conducted among 1,117 U.S. adults and had a margin of error of 3 percentage points. The immigration approval has also decreased from 39% since January, but that drop falls within the margin of error. Reuters reported that the fall in immigration approval is disproportionately large among men. In 2025, immigration approval with men was close to 50%, but the latest Reuters Ipsos poll showed 41% of men gave Trump positive reviews on the issue. Trump campaigned on a promise of mass deportation, and while his overall approval ratings remain historically low, ratings on border security and immigration usually rank higher than other issues like the economy. In a rare backtrack, the Trump administration said recently it would ramp down its immigration enforcement operation in Minnesota after federal agents fatally shot two U.S. citizens. Here is what you know about how Americans are reacting to Trump overall. Reuters Ipsos, 38% approve of Trump's job performance. The latest Reuters Ipsos poll gives Trump a 38% approval rating, unchanged from a previous poll at the end of January. That is down from 47% at the start of his term, per Reuters. What is Donald Trump's average approval rating? Averages calculated by the New York Times and Real Clear Politics aggregators show Trump's approval rating has been net negative since the spring of his first year back in office. From April to November, it stayed relatively stable until dropping suddenly, rebounding slightly in December and dropping again since the turn of the new year. Real Clear Politics graphics show 42% approve of Trump's job performance and 55.5% disapprove as of February 17th. Both are the worst of this term, with a net approval rating of negative 13.5 percentage points. The New York Times aggregator shows 40% approve of Trump's job performance as of February 18th. It is the lowest of this term per the Times, but he first reached it on February 12th. His disapproval is also at 56%, the highest of this term that he first reached on November 19th. Gateway Project. Gateway Tunnel work to resume after Trump DOT order to release funds. The rail tunnel under the Hudson River between New Jersey and New York is meant to expand service along the nation's busiest passenger rail line, by Eduardo Cuevas. New York. Construction on the nation's largest infrastructure project can resume after a court ordered the Trump administration to release funding it had withheld to gain leverage over congressional Democrats from New York. On February 18th, New York Attorney General Letitia James announced the U.S. Department of Transportation released nearly $130 million in funding for the $16 billion Gateway Tunnel project in an ongoing lawsuit. The rail tunnel project under the Hudson River between New Jersey and New York is meant to bolster tunnels along the Northeast Corridor, the busiest passenger rail line in the United States. The funding resuming is a blow to President Donald Trump, who had vowed to terminate the project in a budget fight with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York. This funding freeze was unlawful from the start, James, who has herself been targeted for legal retribution by Trump, said in a statement. We took swift action in court, and now every dollar that was illegally withheld has been released. The Manhattan-based U.S. Attorney's Office, representing federal officials in court, declined to comment. Neither the White House nor the U.S. Department of Transportation immediately responded to requests for comment. Construction had already started at several sites before federal officials abruptly pulled funding. Around $2 billion had already been spent on the project, New York officials said. The project would create 9 miles of new passenger rail tracks with a two-tube tunnel, and it would fix the existing 116-year-old tunnels currently used by Amtrak and New Jersey Transit trains that were damaged during Superstorm Sandy in 2012. Just one tunnel failing could cost the nation's largest regional economy billions of dollars annually, equivalent to over 30,000 jobs, according to the nonprofit Regional Planning Association. Trump, a former New York real estate mogul who has called himself the builder president but has failed to pass an infrastructure investment bill, put the project to a halt in the fall during the federal government shutdown. On the first day of the shutdown, on October 1st, federal officials withheld grants to the Gateway Project and the Second Avenue subway construction in Manhattan, citing New York City's disadvantaged business enterprise program, an equity initiative meant to expand participation in federally assisted contracts. I'm cutting the project, Trump told Fox News. The project is going to be dead, he said. It is pretty much dead right now. Trump had also reportedly wanted New York's Penn Station and Virginia's Dulles International Airport renamed after him in order to drop his freeze on billions of federal dollars on the Gateway Project. Trump later said his staff floated the idea, not him. In early February, the project stopped, affecting about 1,000 workers due to a lack of funding. On February 3rd, New York and New Jersey attorneys general sued the administration to release funding. U.S. District Judge Jeanette A. Vargas then issued a temporary restraining order in Manhattan federal court and later required funds be released with updates on payment of all present and future disbursements. The federal government owed about $230 million, according to James's office. On February 13th, officials released $30 million, followed by an additional $77 million released February 17th, James's office said. The Gateway Development Commission, the joint corporation between New Jersey and New York overseeing the project, received the remaining funds, about $127 million via wire the morning of February 18th. Tom Prendergast, CEO of the Commission, said in a February 18th statement that contractors would be notified in the afternoon that work will resume next week. The project now has more than $205 million available to fund work, he said. A day earlier, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat, stood alongside union leaders and workers at a project work site in New York City. She said Trump's halt put thousands of jobs at risk. Today's progress is significant, but we need certainty that Gateway funding will remain in place for the duration of the project, Hochul said in a February 18th statement. The federal government has a legal obligation to fully fund Gateway, and New York will accept nothing less. The Building and Construction Trades Council of Greater New York, which represents workers on the project, did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The Northeast Corridor serves about 800,000 passenger trips daily, the commission said. The section of the project between New Jersey and Manhattan is the busiest portion of the corridor. TV. NBC's Steve Koronacki dispels a common myth about his trademark khakis, by Ralphie Aversa. New York. Audiences have grown accustomed to watching Steve Koronacki, the chief data analyst at NBC News and NBC Sports, break down numbers pertaining to both elections and major sporting events on his signature big board. Koronacki's coverage is called upon for election nights, the Super Bowl, and the Olympics. But as complex as those statistics can be, the person recalling all of the information tries to keep things pretty simple. On a cold February afternoon, Koronacki eschews a black car or Uber and makes the relatively short walk from 30 Rock to the USA Today newsroom in his trademark khakis and a pair of New Balance sneakers. And while he realizes that people think he has a closet full of hundreds of khaki pants, in reality the journalist says he only has two or three. Growing up, elections and sports were his passions. Fashion was not. My mom was always trying to make me a little bit more fashionable and stuff, and I always kind of resisted. Koronacki, 46, recalls to USA Today of his upbringing in Massachusetts. So maybe I have some aversion to it, he adds with a laugh, while also noting that he's never really had good answers for questions about his wardrobe. The fascination with Koronacki's attire began after the 2020 election. With the COVID lockdown, the journalist recalls that there was really nobody in 30 Rock. Thinking nothing of the pants he was wearing at the time, Koronacki tucked in his shirt so it looked neater, put on a tie, and went on the set. And then, a day or two later, my producer's asking me, "What brand of pants are you wearing?" Koronacki says. I said, "What kind of a question is this?" The pants were from Gap. Koronacki has since traded in the khaki color for a darker blue, but what has not changed, even in this day of AI and algorithms, is his approach to preparing for election nights. I print out blank county maps of states and I fill them in myself, Koronacki says of his old-school process, which he's currently in the middle of with two Texas Senate primaries on March 3rd. I have a whole color-coding system based on past election results, based on demographic patterns, and I update them after every election. Koronacki explains that the repetition of filling out the maps ahead of every election cycle gives him a better chance at recalling information without pausing or freezing up. Some of his prep can also be seen on the night of the election. NBC streams Koronacki Cam, an alternate angle of the broadcast focused solely on the journalist. The additional screen, which is live during both the broadcast and commercial breaks, will return for NBC's coverage of the primaries in March. The last Koronacki cam in December racked up more than 1.5 million views across all platforms. And so when Koronacki wraps this interview, he'll walk back to his office and continue to study the 254 counties in Texas. He's also in the middle of Winter Olympics coverage, which is why he walked over in the first place. The games in Milan have spurred a new assignment for the journalist, an online series called Keeping Score with Koronacki. Steve Koronacki helps viewers keep score during the Winter Games. It is a dizzying month of sports at the Peacock Network. NBC broadcast the Super Bowl, the NBA All-Star Game, and is now airing the Winter Olympics. Keeping Score with Korinaki, launched ahead of the Winter Games, can be seen by NBC News subscribers on the network's website or app. Korinaki has brought the same mindset from election and football coverage to this project. Learn something new and share it with the audience. The journalist brings up the Olympic debut of Skimo, ski mountaineering, as an example of a sport that was perfect for his series. "I call this one skiing without the chairlift," he jokes. Basically, they race up the hill, then they turn around and race back down the hill, and there's permutations within that. But how does that work? How do you keep score? What are the rules of that? What are people watching? What I love about the Olympics is just so many of these sports are so exotic and so different than anything that I'm thinking about or dealing with day to day, Korinaki says. Recent segments have covered bobsledding and speed skating. It's really fun to try to figure out what the structure of these sports is, and again, I think a lot of people have that experience watching these games. Politics. People's State of the Union. What Democrats plan for Trump's speech. Among the boycotters are Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, whose state has been plagued by immigration raids, and Representative Veronica Escobar, whose El Paso district was subjected to a sudden air travel freeze by Zachary Schirmel, Washington. In yet another sign of fading bipartisanship, prominent Democrats are planning a big boycott of President Donald Trump's first official State of the Union address of his second term. Refusing to legitimize the February 24th speech, 12 lawmakers said they would skip it and instead hold a rally on the National Mall that they're calling the People's State of the Union. The list of Democrats includes 5 senators and 7 members of the House of Representatives. Midas Touch and Move On Civic Action, the progressive organizations putting the event together, said February 18th more guests will be announced. The size of the counter-programming marks a departure from Democrats' typical responses to such occasions. Though they've protested President Trump in high-profile ways during his past addresses to Congress, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi once ripped up a copy of his speech, most lawmakers on both sides of the aisle typically attend States of the Union. The other party then gives a rebuttal that TV networks air just after the presidential address. Regardless of lawmakers' issues with the occupant of the Oval Office, sitting through the speech is a long-standing, bipartisan tradition. This year is different, though, according to Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut. The potential 2028 presidential contender said in a statement that Trump has repeatedly made a mockery of such speeches, taking a moment that is meant to bring the country together and turning it into a campaign rally to spew hatred and division. These aren't normal times, and showing up for the speech puts a veneer of legitimacy on the corruption and lawlessness that has defined his second term, Murphy said. Among the boycotters are Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, whose state has been plagued by immigration raids and the killings of Alex Preti and Renee Nicole Good, as well as Representative Veronica Escobar, whose El Paso district was recently subjected to a sudden airspace freeze. The other senators not attending the speech are Ed Markey of Massachusetts, Jeff Merkley of Oregon, and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. The other members of the House not attending are Yasemin Ansari of Arizona, Becca Ballant of Vermont, Greg Kossar of Texas, Pramila Jayapal of Washington, Delia Ramirez of Illinois, and Bonnie Watson Coleman of New Jersey. The White House has said the State of the Union speech will continue ahead as scheduled, even though the Department of Homeland Security will likely remain in a partial government shutdown amid a funding stalemate in Congress. Gas prices and vehicle fueling. Trump sued over fuel rules. Plan to bring car prices tumbling down. By Keith Lang. President Donald Trump's administration is being sued over his plan to bring car prices tumbling down dramatically by slashing federal emissions regulations and fuel economy standards. The Natural Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, and other environmental groups said they filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that challenges the agency's recent decision to finalize a new rule that will rescind an Obama-era scientific finding that greenhouse gas emissions from cars and other sources pose a threat to public health. The lawsuit was filed on Wednesday, February 18th, in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. The EPA defended its decision to rescind the climate finding, saying in a statement that was provided to USA Today that it carefully considered and re-evaluated the legal foundation of the 2009 endangerment finding, the text of the Clean Air Act, and the endangerment finding's legality in light of subsequent legal developments and court decisions. The EPA's 2009 finding, known as the endangerment finding, has provided the legal basis for the federal government's most ambitious efforts to slash planet-warming car emissions, including rules that currently require automakers to achieve an average of more than 50 miles per gallon for all the cars across their fleets. The Trump administration has promised that rolling back stringent fuel economy rules will allow automakers to make cheaper cars, but the environmental groups that sued the EPA said the agency's elimination of the endangerment finding is illegal, and its decision to eliminate federal regulation of auto emissions will cost drivers $6,000 over the lifetime of the vehicles. The EPA's own analysis found that eliminating the vehicle standards will increase gas prices, force Americans to spend more on fuel, and be a net negative for the economy, the environmental groups said. What does it mean for car buyers? The federal fuel economy rules that the Trump administration is trying to eliminate require automakers to produce car fleets that are capable of averaging over 50 miles per gallon by 2031. The White House says eliminating the rules will drastically lower sticker prices for most car shoppers. This action will eliminate over $1.3 trillion of regulatory costs and help bring car prices tumbling down dramatically, Trump said in the February 12th White House event announcing the action. You're going to get a better car. You're going to get a car that starts easier, a car that works better, for a lot less money. Environmentalists sharply disagree, saying that the Trump administration's ruling that the 2009 endangerment finding is invalid relied on junk science and won't impact car prices much at all, but they said it will make the U.S. environment much worse. This is not a mere rollback, Brian Link, senior attorney at the Environmental Law and Policy Center, said in a statement. EPA is attempting to completely disavow its statutory authority to regulate greenhouse gases from motor vehicles. What happened to car prices last time Trump slashed federal fuel rules? In March 2017, Trump first announced his plan to roll back stringent fuel economy rules that were enacted under former President Barack Obama that would have required automakers to achieve fleet-wide averages of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. When Trump made that announcement, the average price of a new car was $34,342, according to Kelley Blue Book. Trump's first rollback resulted in federal fuel mileage standards being frozen at about 39 miles per gallon for model years 2021 to 2026. The mileage rules change coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic, which saw dramatic increases in prices for cars and many other goods. The average price of a new car in January was $49,191, according to Kelley Blue Book. When former President Joe Biden took office in January 2021, he moved almost immediately to restore the stringent Obama-era fuel economy standards. Biden eventually settled on a plan that was announced in August 2021 that would have required automakers to achieve fleet-wide averages of around 50 miles per gallon by 2031. The average price of a new car then was $43,355. Trump says his new proposal would eliminate all federal regulation of auto emissions. Stephanie Valdez-Streedy, director of industry insights at Cox Automotive, said in a statement provided to USA Today that historically changes to fuel economy or emissions rules do not translate into material sticker price relief for consumers. New vehicle prices increase an average of approximately 3% a year, and changes in regulations have not significantly altered that long-term trend, she said. Melissa Gilbert. Melissa Gilbert speaks out to fans amid husband's sex abuse charges. By Anna Kaufman. Melissa Gilbert is sending a message to fans amid her husband's legal battle over accusations of child sex abuse. the Little House on the Prairie Star, 61, took to social media Monday, February 16th, to share that she would be returning to work thoughtfully and with care, as her spouse, actor Timothy Busfield, faces a grand jury indictment over charges of criminal sexual contact of a child. As many of you know, I stepped away for a little while to focus on my family, Gilbert said in a post to the Instagram of Modern Prairie, the actress's lifestyle company named after her most famous role. It was time I needed. Time to be present, to tend to what matters most, and to gather my strength in a season that has not been easy. Family is everything to me, and during this incredibly difficult time, I leaned into that truth fully, Gilbert continued. But something else carried me too. You did. This extraordinary community at Modern Prairie, you wrapped me in love. Even when I was quiet, I felt your prayers. I felt your encouragement. I felt your steady presence. Busfield, whom Gilbert wed in 2013, was arrested earlier this month in connection with allegations of abusing minors. The West Wing actor, 68, is accused of abusing minors during his time filming the television series The Cleaning Lady. Between 2022 and early 2024, Busfield allegedly abused two young actors who were 7 and 8 years old at the time as they worked on the series, according to prosecutors. The actor also served as director on the show. He has denied any wrongdoing. In her video message, Gilbert praised the women in this community who show up every single day, not just for me, but for one another, adding, "That is what Modern Prairie is. Women supporting women, not just when it's easy, and especially when it's hard." The actress and entrepreneur, who has stood by her husband as he heads to trial, went on to signal that resolve. "Coming back to work does not change my commitment or my resolve to the journey that lies ahead for my family. That remains steadfast. That remains in my heart," she said. "But it is important for me to step back into this work. It strengthens my mindset. It gives me purpose. It reminds me of who I am beyond hard days." Gilbert concluded her message by saying, "I am so proud to walk forward with you, so let's get back at it together." Timothy Busfield allegations explained. Busfield has argued that the allegations he faces are an act of retaliation after the allegedly abused boys were recast on the show. In several court appearances, the actor has appeared in an orange prison uniform, as Gilbert watches on from the courtroom. Busfield's alleged abuse of the child actors is said to have occurred between late 2022 and early 2024. One child claimed that Busfield had touched his genitals several times. Both say Busfield touched them inappropriately and instructed them to call him Uncle Tim. According to the criminal complaint, the children's mother reported the incidents to Child Protective Services. One child has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety and feared disclosing the alleged abuse because of retaliation from Busfield, the complaint claims. In 2024, University of New Mexico Hospital staff members requested an investigation because it appeared the boys were being groomed. According to the affidavit, Busfield acknowledged to police in a phone interview that the set was a playful environment and that he had probably tickled the boys. Production assistants told Albuquerque police that Busfield was sometimes touchy or unprofessional. During a motion for pretrial detention on January 14th, an alleged victim's father, Colin Swift, revealed that he told law enforcement the day prior that Busfield sexually abused his daughter several years ago in California. Centers for Disease Control. NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya, a critic of COVID lockdowns, to temporarily run CDC, by Ahmed Abulanin, Julie Steenhuisen, and Bo Erickson. U.S. National Institutes of Health Director Jay Bhattacharya will step in as acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a Trump administration official said on February 18th. Part of a broader shakeup within the Health Department ahead of midterm elections. Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary Jim O'Neill, who has been serving as acting CDC director since August, will vacate both roles as part of a leadership restructuring within the department. The official added, O'Neill will be offered the position of National Science Foundation Director. Bhattacharya's appointment was first reported by the New York Times on February 18th, while Politico reported O'Neill's departure last Friday. Dual role. Bhattacharya, a Stanford University professor who gained prominence as a leading critic of lockdowns and widespread COVID-19 restrictions, already leads the nation's premier medical research agency based in Maryland, where he oversees a nearly $50 billion budget and funding for thousands of scientific projects. He is now tasked with also leading the Atlanta-based CDC, which tracks and responds to domestic and foreign threats to public health. Roughly two-thirds of its budget provides funds to the public health and prevention activities of state and local health agencies. The notion that the current director of the NIH can take on the mantle of another federal agency in his spare time is hard to understand, said Dan Jernigan, who resigned as director of the CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases in August. The NIH and the CDC, both of which require full-time attention, are in different cities, said Deb Howery, former chief medical officer at the CDC. This puts our nation at greater risk for not being able to respond to health threats and outbreaks, she said. CDC turmoil. The CDC has faced significant instability, including budget cuts, staff reductions, and controversies under Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime anti-vaccine activist. President Donald Trump fired then-CDC Director Susan Monterez in August after she resisted changes to vaccine policy advanced by Kennedy that she believed contradicted scientific evidence, further destabilizing the already embattled agency. Her dismissal triggered the resignations of four senior CDC officials, including Howery and Jernigan, who cited anti-vaccine policies and misinformation pushed by Kennedy. Under O'Neill's tenure, the CDC eliminated long-standing vaccine guidance for children in January and approved an advisory panel's recommendation against early use of a combined measles, mumps, rubella, varicella vaccine in October. The advisory panel had been gutted, then restaffed by Kennedy with hand-picked, vocal vaccine opponents. Deadline. Per federal law, Bhattacharya can serve as acting CDC director only until late March, unless Trump nominates a full-time nominee. The law requires Trump to nominate a replacement within 210 days of Monterez's firing, which took place in late August, and changing the acting director does not restart the clock. The 210-day limit is paused, however, as long as a nomination is pending in the U.S. Senate, allowing Bhattacharya or another acting director to remain while the confirmation process unfolds. HHS shakeup. Kennedy announced wider changes to his team last week, including the elevation of Chris Klomp as chief counselor at HHS, tasked to oversee all operations of the department. Klomp currently serves as deputy administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as director of Medicare. Kennedy said he would retain his roles at CMS. Kennedy also announced that Kyle Diamantas and Grace Graham will serve as senior counselors for the Food and Drug Administration and John Brooks as senior counselor for CMS. Midterm strategy. The new HHS roles are meant to increase communication between the department and the White House ahead of the 2026 midterm election, an administration official explained. White House officials, cabinet secretaries, and Republican campaign operatives met in Washington this week for a briefing on the party's midterm campaign, according to a person who attended. Republicans plan to focus in part on health care insurance costs, prescription drug affordability, and by having Kennedy focus on access to healthy food. Olympics. How overtime and shootouts work in Olympics hockey, by Mike Brem. Olympics hockey, just like the NHL, does not allow for ties. A game will go to overtime if it is tied after 60 minutes, and there is also the possibility of a shootout if the game remains tied once an overtime period ends. But there are differences between NHL rules and Olympics rules on how overtimes and shootouts are conducted. The maximum length of a sudden death overtime depends on the round in which the game is being played, and the shootout format is totally different from the one used by the NHL. Here is an explainer on how overtimes and shootouts work in Olympics hockey. Olympics overtime rules. If the teams are tied after 60 minutes in the preliminary round, a 5-minute sudden death overtime will be played at 3-on-3. Unlike the NHL, teams don't change ends for overtime. Overtime in a playoff game, along with the bronze medal game, lasts a maximum of 10 minutes. It's also 3-on-3 as opposed to 5-on-5 in NHL playoff games. In the gold medal game, teams play 20-minute, 3-on-3 overtime periods, separated by 15-minute intermissions, until someone scores. Teams don't change sides for the first overtime, but do for subsequent overtimes. Olympics shootout rules. If overtime doesn't settle a game outside of the gold medal game, there will be a shootout. The winner of a coin toss gets to choose whether their team shoots first or second. The format differs from the NHL, with 5 shooters per team instead of 3. If nothing is settled after 5 rounds, then each round is sudden death, as in the NHL. But there's another difference. Olympics teams can use the same shooters multiple times during the sudden death rounds. Think back to TJ Oshie in the 2014 Olympics. They also can change goaltenders. In the sudden death round, the team that shot second in the first 5 rounds will shoot first. The rounds continue until one team finishes with one more goal than the other. That team is declared the winner. Overtime games at the 2026 Winter Olympics. February 15th, men, Switzerland 4, Czechia 3. Switzerland's Dean Kukan scored at 1 minute, 49 seconds of overtime. February 18th, men, Canada 4, Czechia 3, Finland 3, Switzerland 2, USA 2, Sweden 1. Avalanches. California Avalanche was deadliest in U.S. in 45 years, by Natalie Nasa Alund. The avalanche that killed at least 8 people on February 17th in California marked the deadliest natural disaster of its kind in the United States in nearly a half century. A group of 15 skiers were caught in the avalanches in the Castle Peak area of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, northwest of Lake Tahoe. 6 members of the group survived and were rescued. 1 skier was still missing as of February 18th and is presumed dead, Nevada County Sheriff Shannon Moon said. It was the deadliest avalanche in the U.S. in almost 45 years, according to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, CIAC, which tracks avalanches across the nation. 11 people were killed in an avalanche on June 21, 1981, while attempting to climb Mount Rainier in Washington State. More recently, 6 climbers died in an avalanche on Mount Rainier on May 28, 2014. On April 20, 2013, 5 snowboarders were killed in an avalanche near Colorado's Loveland Pass. In the U.S., avalanches have claimed an average of 27 lives annually over the last 10 years, according to the CAIC. What was the deadliest avalanche in U.S. history? The deadliest recorded avalanche in U.S. history occurred March 1, 1910, in Wellington, Washington, when a wall of snow swept 2 trains into a gorge near Stevens Pass in the Cascade Range, killing 96 people, according to the Seattle Times. Snowstorms and blizzards. Weekend snow storm forecast keeps changing. A late weekend nor'easter is in the forecast for the East Coast, but specific details remain uncertain as of February 18th, by Doyle Rice. A late weekend nor'easter is in the forecast for the East Coast, but specific details on its location, strength, and precipitation type all remain uncertain as of Wednesday, February 18th. An East Coast storm could develop as soon as Sunday, February 22nd, but the track of this potential nor'easter isn't yet determined, leaving impacts such as snow, rain, wind, and coastal flooding uncertain from New England to the mid-Atlantic states, said weather.com meteorologist Jonathan Erdman in a February 18th online forecast. While a storm is still likely, its impacts are not a done deal yet. According to AccuWeather meteorologist Brandon Buckingham, there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle that would have to come together at the right time for a major storm to unfold and bring heavy snow late this weekend to early next week. As of the morning of February 18th, the National Weather Service, in an online forecast discussion, said that going into the Sunday, February 22nd to Monday, February 23rd time period, there is still a strong signal for an intensifying low-pressure system off the mid-Atlantic coast. However, the Weather Service said that recent weather model guidance has trended a little bit more offshore compared to earlier models that had it closer to the coast near New England. Specifically, the Weather Service said the European model takes it more out to sea, and the other guidance has also trended a little more in that direction. This could still bring impacts to the coastal areas, but would result in lesser inland impacts farther up the coast, the Weather Service said. The main uncertainty is where this offshore low tracks, Erdman said. That affects who may see snow, rain, wind, and coastal flooding, and the magnitude of those impacts. He said one possibility is that the storm will form too late or too far offshore to have major impacts to coastal areas other than some light rain, snow, and gusty coastal winds on Sunday, February 22nd. The other possibility is that the snow intensifies and tracks closer to the coast, bringing a threat of coastal flooding along with heavier rain or snow and high winds to the coast and to some extent inland, Erdman said. For now, more of the computer model solutions are leaning toward the first, farther offshore scenario, but it's too soon to be certain of that, as it could change, he added. This concludes the presentation of USA Today for Thursday, February 19th, 2026. My name is Elizabeth Ingber with the Talking Information Center. As always, thank you.